Brady drops protection, throws the deep ball toward the corner end zone. Scotty Miller in it. He's got the ball. Touchdown, Tampa Bay. Touchdown, Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Scotty Miller. Great throw by Brady.
That was 43-year-old Tom Brady with one of his five touchdowns Sunday, helping the Bucs blow out the Raiders. For years, the NFL has tried and failed to solve the mystery of how to stop that man. Today, Bill Barnwell plays detective to sleuth out the answer to that question and the NFL's biggest mysteries from a wild Week 7. Plus, what will happen November 3rd? We run the numbers on the NFL's trade deadline. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, October 26th. This is ESPN Daily. All right, Bill Barnwell. It is just after midnight on Monday. I would say that I just finished flipping between Game 5 of the World Series, which the Dodgers won 4-2, and this absurd Seahawks-Cardinals game, except the Seahawks-Cardinals game kept on going and going until Seattle lost in overtime, 37-34. My brain got absorbed entirely by it, and you're writing about the NFL's unsolved mysteries this week. So can I start with a simple but mystifying question?
You can, but now I'm concerned that I don't have it covered in my column this week.
Well, the question is this. Why are the Seahawks always playing in games that never fail to make everybody watching them feel like they're taking psychotropic drugs?
Okay, this one I actually can answer, thankfully. It's a weird like cocktail of brilliance and incompetence at the same time somehow to have these sorts of games happen week after week. And I think what's so interesting about this, Pablo, is that the Seahawks have really been at this for 2 years now. And they've had two totally different formulas over that time frame. Last year, of course, the Seahawks would spend three quarters bumbling around, usually trailing, and then they would turn things over in the fourth quarter to Russell Wilson, who would then somehow be brilliant for 15 minutes and manufacture a lead, which they would hold on to for a narrow victory. The defense would do just enough to hold up its end of the bargain throughout the game, and the Seahawks were very successful. Now, this year, obviously, the offense has taken a huge leap forward. Russell Wilson has taken over for all four, or in this case, five quarters. At the same time, though, the defense has taken a major step backwards. The Seahawks have the worst pass rush in all of football by most measures. They did not knock down Kyler Murray once in this game as a passer. And we've seen them struggle in the second half of games once their core players on defense get tired. That is, until the last possible moment for the defense to succeed, at which point, inexplicably, they've somehow come up with stops. This is the same defense that was getting run over by the Patriots and Vikings until fourth end the game, at which point they would come up with a stop in short yardage, and then the Seahawks would go on to win the contest. In overtime, the Cardinals had three possessions to try and win the game. The Seahawks normally don't give other opposing teams three possessions to try and win the game if Russell Wilson only needs one possession to score. Russell Wilson has given that Seahawks defense an incredible amount of leeway with how well he's played. But in this game, where he was very good generally, but still had three interceptions, that margin for error was erased. Cliff Kingsbury, with his offense gashing the Seahawks on the ground, decided to sit on the football and try a 42-yard field goal on second down in overtime. I think the real lesson to take away from Seahawks games is that it's usually the one who dares to make the most inexplicable decision who wins. I am in favor of an NFL that plays out like two 10-year-olds playing Madden, and that's really what the NFL has kind of become in 2020. And honestly, today it was great.
It was. So let's turn to a team, though, that started off somewhat chaotic, a headline-grabbing mystery in their own right, but has since found a pretty good amount of stability in these last few weeks, because Tom Brady's Buccaneers looked fantastic against the Raiders on Sunday. They blew them out 45-20 in Vegas. And while we have to acknowledge it was a real strange week for those Raiders, their O-line had been temporarily sidelined by COVID concerns, this game felt like Brady at the best that I've seen him, at least, in a long while. So the big question now, Bill, is how? How has Tom Brady been staving off Father Time successfully again?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's difficult to kind of parse out what actually matters when we're judging how a player's playing or what impacts his performance. I mean, there have been two games this year where he's been pressured more than 20% of the time, the loss to the Bears and the loss to the Saints. The other five games, he hasn't been pressured 20% of the time. It's 17% or less. They've won all five of those games. The Raiders pressured Brady just 7% of the time on Sunday. That's a really low number. That's one of the lowest numbers you're going to see for any defense all season. Brady subsequently posted a passer rating of 127, his best mark as a Buccaneers player so far. And I think what's interesting about this is that we're seeing Brady really spread the ball around. I think when you might have thought about how he would approach the offense coming to Tampa Bay, one of the benefits was that he had a pair of dominant wide receivers in Mike Evans and Chris Godwin. Well, we've seen Rob Gronkowski, who was not a part of the offense to the point where it became a joke over the first month of the season, look more like his old self over the last couple of weeks. And honestly, the key wideout on Sunday was Scotty Miller, who had six catches for 109 yards and a touchdown. And what makes Scotty Miller so interesting is that he is the guy who is probably going to lose his job, or at least lose his snaps in the wide receiver rotation, once Antonio Brown joins this team. So I'm sure that will not be an issue if the Buccaneers struggle once Antonio Brown arrives.
Yeah, that is a recipe for a certain amount of disaster, but it's also a good problem to have. I mean, theoretically, Tampa Bay is going to suffer from a glut of weapons on offense in that scenario. But Brady's former team, Bill, had something approaching the opposite problem on Sunday against the Niners, who destroyed New England 33-6. And the offensive deficit there starts at quarterback now, because Cam Newton, Brady's replacement, he was making Bill Belichick look like a genius at the start of the season. And now he has Belichick desperately playing Jared Stidham in relief. So the mystery in New England then feels like what happened to Cam Newton.
It's been very strange. And Newton really looks like something is wrong with him. Over the last two games, he has five interceptions on 40 pass attempts.
Cam drops back, looks down the middle. He throws it off Edelman's hand. Careens in the air, picked off. Running it back across the 30-yard line. Jamar Taylor with the interception. And he is brought down to the play.
He's had a problem with the ball coming out funny and landing well short, even on simple passes to the flat that are 2 or 3 yards downfield. It's something we associate more with just inconsistent mechanics. And of course, Cam only returned 2 weeks ago after battling coronavirus. And it's impossible to say whether Newton is dealing with the after effects of COVID, but we know it's impacting players in different ways. We just heard on Sunday that Jaguars running back Raquel Armstead, who contracted the illness during the preseason, is going to miss the entire year and has been hospitalized twice. Bill Belichick said after the game that Newton is still the team's starter. But I think that's just a product of limited options. Jared Stidham, who replaced Newton, has not been effective in two substitute appearances. Brian Hoyer was benched during his spot start against the Chiefs. The Patriots' best hope of competing for a playoff spot is realistically having Newton in the lineup and playing at the level we saw from him earlier this year. So they're going to have to hope that Cam recovers and looks something like his former self in the weeks to come.
The other massive quarterback question that came up on Sunday was in Dallas, Bill. And there is a character that I met for the first time named Ben DiNucci. And I truly, like, you could have made that dude up and I would not have known the difference. So he comes in because the replacement for Dak Prescott, who had that brutal ankle injury 2 weeks ago, is Andy Dalton. Andy Dalton ended up with a concussion, and in comes the aforementioned Ben DiNucci, who finished the game out for the Cowboys. And it turns out that DiNucci may also get the start next Sunday against the Eagles if Dalton doesn't clear the concussion protocol. So what are the Cowboys' options at quarterback here, Bill?
Oh, okay. In a typical circumstance, if you had a car and the engine wasn't running, that'd be a big problem. But if your car also has no wheels, doors, or gas, the engine's not really that big of a deal. You need to have an engine for the car to work, but there's eight other problems with the car too. The only guy left who has been with the Cowboys all offseason is, in fact, one Ben DiNucci, a seventh rounder from James Madison who once backed up Nathan Peterman at Pitt.
Wait.
Yes.
He backed up the Peterman? That's who Ben DiNucci is?
Not good enough to topple the Peterman. Granted, he was a freshman. The Peterman had more experience, but the only other option on the Dallas roster is Garrett Gilbert. And Garrett Gilbert only signed from the Cleveland practice squad after Dak Prescott blew out his ankle. At the same time, let's say the Cowboys could magically go out and get someone like Ryan Fitzpatrick and somehow have him learn their system in time for that critical game with the Eagles on Sunday.
Mm.
Is it really going to matter? I mean, Dallas started four backup linemen on Sunday. Their players cannot stop fumbling. They allowed Washington, not a great offense, the Washington football team, to run for 208 yards. Quarterback is a problem for the Cowboys, Pablo, but everything is a problem for the Cowboys.
Man. All right, Bill, coming up, it is a big day on November 3rd. So I want you to help me get ready for, of course, the NFL trade deadline.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So, Bill, the entire nation, I think it's safe to say, has been counting down the days to November 3rd for weeks and weeks now. And it's all for the same reason, of course. It is NFL trade deadline day. So I am here for the good of our country to get into some trade talk with you. So let's deal with the when first off. So do you think we'll see teams hold off until the trade deadline to actually make some moves here?
No, Pablo. I actually think we're going to see two deadlines. We're going to see a sort of soft deadline on this Thursday, October 29th, and then the actual official deadline on November 3rd. Mm. And there's a reason why. It's because of the league's COVID protocol. We saw this with Le'Veon Bell, actually, where Le'Veon Bell was picked up by the Chiefs. There was an onboarding period where he was not allowed to practice or play for the team. And he played, of course, made his debut on Sunday. Because the league has that onboarding period, players can't just get traded and hop onto their new teams immediately. Now, if teams make their trades by this Thursday, October 29th, they'll then be able to use those players as early as week 9. But if you wait until November 3rd, those players won't be able to suit up until week 10. So teams might just delay their shopping for the last possible second. That happens to the best of us. But I do think that you're going to see maybe the smarter teams and more aggressive teams try to get trades done by this Thursday.
In terms of this deadline, which teams need to be aggressive here?
Well, I think actually a lot of teams can justify being aggressive, in part because the league's now moved to a 14-team playoff. So really, a lot of teams on the margins here might think they have a credible shot of getting hot and making it to the postseason. There's really only a few teams who are in fire sale mode. The Giants, Jets, Texans, Vikings. There really may be more sellers than buyers over the next week. There's a lot of young teams that come to mind for me. A team like the Browns, for example, where they might have lost Odell Beckham to a serious knee injury yesterday. That would leave them without much at wide receiver. So they might look at help both to compete over the second half of the season and to help evaluate Baker Mayfield, who, by the way, was awesome yesterday.
Yeah.
The Niners are 4-3, but they've been ripped apart by injuries, not only at running back and wide receiver, but even more so on the defensive side of the ball. But I also wouldn't be surprised if they went into the market and tried to add help along their defensive line. That's a shell of what it was a year ago when that sort of led them to the Super Bowl. And then the Dolphins come to mind for me as a team that's 3-3, but they're in an extremely enviable position. Not only do they have their own picks next year, they have Houston's first and second round picks in the 2021 draft, and the Texans are 1-6. So those could be pretty high picks.
So that's this sort of top-down perspective, the perspective from inside of these front offices. But in terms of the human beings who are on the block that most want out, who are we talking about there?
Oh, man, if this is a competition, I can think of one guy who comes to mind. We'll get to him in a second. But let's start with two veteran Bengals, both of whom have been phased out of the defense. They each played just 11 snaps during Sunday's loss to the Browns. Geno Atkins is a borderline Hall of Famer. When I wrote the column predicting people's Hall of Fame chances before the year, he grades out as someone who has a pretty solid chance, but he's 32 and the Bengals don't see him as part of their future. The only problem is that he's owed $6.5 million in prorated base salary over the rest of the season, which limits his audience. But teams like the Niners, who I just mentioned, and the Raiders, who were competitive today before losing, could be interested in Atkins. But his teammate, Carlos Dunlap, who, like I said, also played just 11 snaps on Sunday, had a very conspicuous response to his very quiet day for the Bengals. He got into an argument with the coaching staff on the sidelines, and then after the game, went on Twitter and posted an ad for his four-bedroom house, which he said is in one of the best school districts in the city.
I mean, it's not just four bedrooms, Bill. There's a big balcony overlooking a river, 4.5 baths. I must confess that I did Google Street Easy plus Carlos Dunlap and got 0 results.
You know what? Anytime you have more bathrooms than bedrooms, I think you're doing something right with your house. I appreciate Carlos Dunlap's sense of style, and I think there may be other teams who appreciate his ability to get after the quarterback. He's a useful edge rusher, and every team in the league needs more players who can get after the quarterback. Any team acquiring Dunlap would have to account for a little over $4.5 million in base salary, but there's so many teams who could use edge rushers. The Seahawks, the Cardinals, the Saints could be in the market. There's a lot of guys out there who could be difference makers in the right spot. There's probably not going to be too much available at quarterback, but there are a couple guys who might make sense. Ryan Fitzpatrick, who has been benched in Miami, could be available if the Dolphins want to make a move. Dwayne Haskins is out of favor in Washington. And the former Ohio State star is still really early enough in his career that I could see teams trying to take a shot on him being their quarterback of the future. There's been chatter about bigger names, but I think most of them will stay put. Let's take the Falcons, who are 1-6. They could theoretically deal Matt Ryan and Julio Jones. But if the Falcons dealt Ryan, they would have $44.4 million in dead money on their cap next year, which is the money that you are paying to someone who is no longer on your roster. Atlanta's already $26 million over next year's cap with Ryan, and that number would rise if he was not on the roster. So even if the Falcons wanted to trade their long-term quarterback, it just does not make realistic sense.
Let's take this opportunity to dive into the Atlanta Falcons. Every single game they play in feels like a Final Destination sequel. Like, you don't know how the loss is coming, you just know that it is, and it's going to be somehow even more absurd than the last thing we saw. So, on Sunday, the Falcons fall to the Detroit Lions 23-22, and it's not exaggerating anything to say, this had to be seen to be believed. So, Bill, tell us what happened in Atlanta.
Okay. So, Pablo, I don't know about you. I feel like 2020 is a year where over and over, we thought things were bad and somehow they get worse. I thought the Falcons had really found every possible way to lose in crushing fashion. But true to 2020, they somehow found a way to make things worse. And before Sunday, I had never seen a game where the defense was celebrating an offensive touchdown to take the lead in the final 2 minutes of the fourth quarter. But that's exactly what happened. 1:12 left to go. The Falcons had a first and 10 from the Detroit 10-yard line, trailing 16-14. All they needed to do to win the game was kneel two times and attempt a 28-yard field goal to win. Teams have hit about 97% of their attempts in that range over the last decade. Instead, the Falcons went to hand the ball to Todd Gurley.
Snapping it at the Detroit 10.
Ball security now. Ball
Gurley
security.
The carry at the
And Gurley broke through the line.
Fell down. Did he fall down shy of the goal line?
Gurley broke the tackle and ran towards the end zone.
Touchdown Atlanta.
The right thing to do would have been to fall down at the 1 yard line and run the rest of the time off the clock before attempting an even easier field goal than that 97% rate I just mentioned.
Mm.
And Pablo, you might think it's impossible for an athlete who sees the end zone in a game-winning situation to turn off that instinct to score. But the exact example of a player who was smart enough to do that twice in the 2018 season was one Todd Gurley. Did that for the Los Angeles Rams. And on top of that, even on this play itself, Todd Gurley remembered that he was not supposed to score, but he just realized it a fraction of a second too late. What happened next almost seemed preordained. The Falcons hit a two-pointer to go up 22-16, but Matthew Stafford completed three passes to get the ball to the 11-yard line before finding TJ Hockenson in the end zone to tie the game up with no time remaining.
Stafford empty out of the gun. He's got it back. Looks, pumps once, steps up, looks, throws, and
yes!
Carr gets down the Detroit Lions. TJ Hockenson, they did it. They've tied it. They're an extra point away from winning this game.
The Lions even took an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty to make the ensuing extra point more difficult. They still have to be the Lions, after all. Matt Prater hit a 48-yard extra point to win the game for the Lions and consign the Falcons to another brutal defeat. Pablo, I promise you, there are Falcons fans tonight, as we record this, who are sitting in their bedrooms wishing they were the New York Jets.
I just felt a chill run down my spine. Bill Barnwell, thank you for terrifying me on another early Monday morning on ESPN Daily.
My pleasure, Papa.
All right, coming up. Nobody in the UFC is better than Khabib Nurmagomedov. Not now, and arguably not ever. So why is the GOAT saying goodbye?
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. Before this past weekend, I had never seen someone regain consciousness and immediately console the man who choked him out. But Khabib Nurmagomedov is not just any man. To many, he's the single greatest fighter in the entire history of mixed martial arts, the very best wrestler the sport has ever seen. And on Saturday, Khabib went right from triangle choking Justin Gaethje, squeezing him with his legs until he passed out in just the second round of UFC 254, to collapsing onto the mat himself, crying and inconsolable. Khabib's father and best friend, Abdulmanap, had died in July. At age 57, due to coronavirus complications. Abdulmanap was the one who had taught Khabib how to wrestle. The one who'd coached him back in Dagestan, a war-torn, semi-autonomous part of Russia that had never produced a single UFC fighter before Khabib. He was the one who prepared his son for each and every fight in his life but this one, on Saturday. So after Khabib stopped Gaethje with the precise techniques his father instilled in him, never wasting a moment, moving with purpose, squeezing his opponent into submission, we saw something unforgettable. We saw the undefeated portrait of invulnerability become the opposite. That's why Gaethje woke up and had to comfort the man who claimed him as his 29th straight victory. And that's why Khabib, composing himself on the mountaintop of MMA, surveyed his kingdom with a newfound, painful clarity. Khabib shared two messages that are still echoing in my head and throughout the sport, still today. The first message was addressed to the public.
Today, I want to say, it was my last fight. And no way I'm going to come here without my father. It was first time when, after what happened with my father, when UFC called me about Justin, I talked with my father, my mother, 3 days. She don't want to go fight without father, but I promise her it's going to be my last fight. And if I give my word, I have to follow this.
His second message was addressed to Gaethje.
I know you're a great man. I know how you take care of your close people. I know a lot of things about you. Be close with your parents, because one day it's going to happen something, because you never know what's going to happen tomorrow.
But here's what we do know. Khabib, the lightweight champion, is retiring as the best pound-for-pound fighter alive. He's never been knocked down, let alone out. He's never even bled in the octagon, not even once. And so much of that dominance is due to his ground game, the career strategy that had been christened before this specific fight in honor of its creator. Father's plan is what Khabib kept calling it. And now the son, at 29-0, is choosing to walk away. But I wouldn't say that Khabib Nurmagomedov is leaving father's plan behind. If you listen to him a bit more closely, actually, it sounds like he just wants to live the way his dad, his best friend, taught him to fight. Never wasting a moment, moving with purpose, and squeezing as much out of life as he could. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.